already receiving a deluge of letters of introduction and requests for commissions. Now that Paris is out, I hope you'll see that this is the perfect time for you to enter the Foreign Office with your Uncle Daniel, said Agatha. I know your father wishes it. I have no interest in sitting in Whitehall learning to order woolen socks by the bushel, said Daniel. Craigmore and I will just start our journal in London and contribute to the cause through our art. I'm sure a journal containing stirring poetry and patriotic sketches would be a welcome and successful enterprise, said his aunt. Beatrice noticed her dry tone and was not at all surprised when Daniel took violent exception.
Good God! That's the worst idea ever, he said. We would surely suffocate under the mudslide of maudlin submissions containing nothing but cheap sentimentality and empty blusterings. No hint of patriotism must be allowed to corrupt the art. If anything, the cause of poetry must always be peace.
You may not find many subscribers in time of war, said Hugh. Poets must also eat and pay rent.
If necessary, we'll run the journal from here, said Daniel.
We'll just move into your garage, Hugh. Behind every poet stands not the muse, but a well-provisioned aunt with a country house, said Hugh. He remained deadpan, drinking his tea, and Beatrice hid a smile.
Exactly, said Daniel.
What would I do without you, Aunt Agatha?
What should the rest of us be doing, Mr. Kent? Asked Beatrice.
One wants to do one's duty. Keep one's regular routine and refuse to show agitation, said John. It is important that we set a good example, because news of this kind has a way of stirring up the population.
I had better get in a few supplies, said Agatha. You know, I like to be prepared.
Hoarding will be frowned upon officially, said her husband. It produces shortages and drives up prices.
Then I will be circumspect about the town, said his wife. But I'll expect you to go to Fortnum and Mason on your way to the office and put in a respectably small order for immediate delivery.
I should get a few things for town, too, said John. My club dinners are bad enough in time of peace. A stock of gentlemen's relish and some potted oysters should see me through some months of hostilities.
Chapter 8. Upon reflection during the days that followed, Hugh could see that the gathering storm clouds in Europe had been well reported in the newspapers, but that, like so many, he had failed to notice the goings-on of the continent.
"I avoid the papers altogether," said Daniel. "I'm pretty sure wars would be shorter if we weren't all so eager to read about them."
"And what are we to do now?" asked Hugh.
"I feel anxious just sitting here."
They were in the garden, Daniel lying in the hammock and Hugh sprawled in an old canvas deck chair.
"My dear cousin, sitting still is quite the best option," said Daniel.
"Did you not hear Uncle John say we are to carry on as normal and refuse to appear concerned?"
"What is normal when there are soldiers guarding the train station and one can't change a £5 note anywhere?"
"I should be so lucky as to be in possession of a £5 note," sighed Daniel.
He let his book fall to the ground and placed his hands behind his head.
"A scent of war does add crispness to the outlines of one's day," he added. "I detected a certain urgency of purpose in the gait of the milkman's horse this morning."
"Oh, do be sensible, Daniel," said Hugh. "Between you playing the fop and Colonel Wheaton enlisting every drunken idiot in front of the town hall, it's as if the whole world has gone mad. I saw the Finch woman photographing a handsome young recruit draped in the Union Jack, with his mother and three little sisters all weeping into bunches of daisies," said Daniel, sighing. "I was quite tempted to enlist myself, just so I too could swoon under the flag and send the picture to Craigmore to make him weep for me. Dr. Lawton says the recruits are a feeble, malnourished lot, and liable to succumb to a chill from the first route march," said Hugh.
"Are you going to help him fatten up the Sussex youth for the front lines?" asked Daniel.
"I have written to my surgeon for advice as to what I should do," said Hugh. "I do not feel able to sit idle if I can be of service in some capacity. I hope to be called to London any day."
"And will your surgeon's daughter be willing to give you up to some war effort, or will she cling to you in this hour of desperation?" asked Daniel.
Hugh frowned, for he was quite sure he had not mentioned her to Daniel, and this meant Daniel had been nosing about his desk again, no doubt stealing all his best pen nibs and laughing at the many drafts it took him to compose a suitably casual note to a woman.
"Miss Ramsay has far too many beaux about her to notice me," said Hugh.
He hoped Daniel would probe no further, as he was not about to confide in his cousin and be rewarded with endless jibes.
"Perhaps you should join the cavalry," said Daniel. "Women love a man in uniform." "And you would stay in flannels and play cricket until the Hun are at the beaches?" asked Hugh.
"I'll have you know, I wrote to Craigmore to propose an immediate launch of our journal in London," said Daniel.
"We shall give our finest young poets and artists a superior forward position from which to defend our nation through art and language."
"I thought you said patriotism is anathema to art," asked Hugh.
"I have decided that, like money, it is best considered a necessary handmaiden to the cause," said Daniel. "Of course I shall keep all patriotic items to the rear of the journal and smother them with illustrated borders so that no one will actually read them."
"You are in a practical mood," said Hugh. "War has had a sobering effect on us all."
"And with concrete results," said Daniel. "Craigmore writes that he and his parents are coming down to visit."
He reached down for his notebook and pulled some onion-skin pages from the middle. "Part of some sort of commission to assess local defense arrangements."
"And does he say his father agrees to your venture?" said Hugh.
"Not in so many words," said Daniel.
"But the universe brings all together.
I am sure Craigmore and I can make an unassailable case for art and poetry as part of our national defenses."
By the last post of the evening, Hugh received a letter summoning him to London, and after some difficulty at the Rye railway station, where the ticket office had no change and the station master graciously allowed him to write an IOU, he set off for London the next morning. The London home of the surgeon Sir Alex Ramsay was a tall Harley Street house of warm red brick, handsomely ornamented with stone and appointed with large windows trimmed with lead window boxes of late summer flowers. A discreet brass plaque was the only suggestion that the house contained the surgeon's consulting rooms, a small suite just beyond the front door. Behind the gracious facade, the home contained a number of commodious rooms with lofty ceilings and wide hallways. Hugh had seen both upstairs and downstairs parlours, the library, and the surgeon's private study. He particularly enjoyed the lower back parlour, which was Lucy's domain, and from which her charmingly arranged conservatory led to an elegant garden with a small carp pond and brick walls lined with espaliered peach and apple trees. Waiting on the front step, Hugh allowed himself a moment to imagine owning such a house, and perhaps a large, well-managed medical practice of similar renown. It would require many years to attain such eminence through his talent and hard work, but he was not afraid of the effort. He acknowledged the flowering of some hope that Lucy Ramsay's affections might smooth his way, but he knew himself innocent of any dark motive. If they were to marry, he thought, any advancement would be mere gilding to this efficiency of love.
"Come in, my boy, come in,"
said the surgeon, waving as the butler showed Hugh into the book-lined consulting room, where only the plainness of the carpet and the slightest hint of carbolic suggested a professional use.
"Lucy has the usual crowd in to tea, but she insisted I must have a few moments' private talk with you alone, Grange."
"I'm honoured," said Hugh, sitting in a comfortably upholstered chair in front of the polished mahogany desk.
"How were the lakes, sir?"
They chatted a while about the hardships of the lecture tour, the crowds at Bellagio, and the superior pleasures of the quiet towns of Lake Como's western shore.
"I think Lucy liked the quiet," said the surgeon.
"A baronet with a phaeton and matching set of white ponies saluted her every day in the gardens, but nothing could turn her pretty head. She's a sensible girl, and no mistake."
"And did you have any trouble getting home?" asked Hugh. "I hear the European banks stopped honouring our drafts."
"We got out just in time," said the surgeon. "The manager at our hotel cashed a check in gold sovereigns, and we caught one of the last trains to get through to Paris before the borders closed for good."
"One or two people were taken from the train, but
but I'm relieved to say that Lucy did not have to witness any nastiness.
He stroked his beard and added,
They were warned not to take up arms, these Belgians, but apparently some of them would not follow orders. Of course I share the communal outrage, and I mean to bring all my expertise and resources to aid my country and my king.
I wanted to ask how I might be of service in those efforts, said Hugh. I do not wish to offer you any less than my full attention as your assistant, but perhaps on my days off I can volunteer some extra hours in one of the hospitals.
That is exactly why I wanted to talk to you, my dear boy, said Sir Alex.
He shuffled some papers on his desk and handed Hugh what appeared to be a list of equipment and staff needed to set up a full hospital with several operating theatres.
This war is the opportunity of a lifetime to advance our field at a rate unheard of in peacetime.
He rubbed his hands.
Think of a new specialist hospital and an unlimited supply of wounded, offering us the opportunity to catalogue every possible type and severity of brain injury.
I envision a whole battery of the new X-ray machines, the latest in equipment from bone saws to drug compounds, and of course, the brightest of our doctors to work with me on this Herculean task.
It would be an enormous advance in the field, said Hugh.
Where will it be, sir? I heard they were commandeering an asylum in Chelsea.
No, no, my boy. We shall go over there, said Sir Alex,
as close to the lions as possible in order to get the freshest cases. Head wounds don't travel well, as you know. I would prefer a seaside location.
In France? Asked Hugh.
He was conscious of a thump of anxiety in his chest. Not fear, he told himself, but just a natural reaction to the idea of going into the war.
The War Office is proving wary of civilian efforts. Too many ladies of the realm wanting to stock a grocer's van and call themselves an ambulance.
Then there is always the question of funding.
Some significant hurdles, agreed Hugh.
They have offered to set up my hospital as a military effort, part of the Royal Army Medical Corps, said the surgeon.
I was concerned, of course, military bureaucracy and all that, but they have offered me a commission.
Congratulations, sir.
Just a colonel rank to start, I believe, said the surgeon.
He tucked a hand in his jacket and straightened his back as he spoke. His contented face suggested he might be contemplating other honours.
In the meantime, I must recruit. I must have the best and brightest. And, of course, that includes you, my boy.
I thank you for the compliment, said Hugh, evading a direct response.
You and Carruthers, and possibly that Michaels chap, though he's asthmatic, if you ask me, probably won't take him, said the surgeon.
Some of you will have to serve where they need you for the few months until we get set up.
It's just that I have only a few months left to be fully qualified, said Hugh. I had thought my place was here.
He had looked forward to assisting the surgeries, to conducting hospital rounds at the side of the eminent surgeon, to working in the clean, tiled laboratories, and to the writing of an academic paper or two. He had planned to continue living simply, but to perhaps buy opera tickets and to invite Lucy to an afternoon or two at the British Museum. And he had seen volunteering in the evenings, an extra surgery here and there to save a limb or an eye, looking for no recognition beyond Lucy's admiration for his indefatigable efforts.
My boy, 1 month at the front will be worth 10 years in the operating rooms of London, said the surgeon. Think of the experience, the papers to be published, and the advancement of our scientific understanding.
Hugh might have added the saving of lives to the surgeon's list of advantages, but he understood that the mind of such a great man was all on the science.
With your permission, I would like to consult my uncle, he said, and I must write to my father abroad.
Plenty of time to decide before the autumn term, said the surgeon.
I hope you receive their blessing. Those notes you put together for me on the effects of keeping patients warm after surgery were quite well received this summer. I had thought we might consider a paper on the subject.
Thank you, said Hugh, though he knew the name of a lowly assistant would not appear on any paper the great man published.
He was thrilled to imagine his ideas being discussed by influential surgeons on the continent.
"I would be sorry to lose you," added the surgeon, giving him a stern look. "And I know Lucy would be sorry to see you part from us."
Hugh's elation evaporated. He did not know quite how to respond, for it was suddenly clear that the surgeon did not mean to continue to supervise any of his students who did not agree to go to France. It had been one of the proudest achievements of Hugh's life to have been chosen to work with Sir Alex, and he had come to feel secure under his wing. Now he felt, like a blow to the chest, that he might have seen genuine affection in what was, perhaps, merely an affable manner.
"Why don't we go to the parlour and ask Lucy to give us a cup of tea?" said the surgeon gently.
"I know she has been counting the moments to your arrival." To walk into a parlour filled with colleagues and friends, with the great surgeon's arm across his shoulders, was to receive such attention, acknowledgement, and not a little envy that Hugh could not but feel comforted. That the surgeon's benevolence might be self-interested did not preclude a genuine warmth, thought Hugh, and he basked in the knowledge that all assembled knew he had just been closeted with the great man.
"Our star brings tales from his country doctoring," said Sir Alex. "I hope you've left him some tea-cakes, Michaels."
Hugh shook hands with his colleagues, and was introduced again to several young ladies of Lucy's circle, who seemed to delight in coming to tea with the young doctors, and then conversing among themselves about all the young men they knew from higher circles. The tea-party spilled into the conservatory, where more young people perched amid troughs of fern and glazed Italian urns of aspergistra and rubber plant. Under the slender arms of two tall potted lime trees that shaded the glass roof, he spotted Lucy sitting on a wicker settee, a low table at her elbow containing the tea-urn and a large platter of cakes. Two of her friends sat with her, doing their patriotic duty by knitting green wool socks for soldiers. His nearest rival for the attention of both the daughter and the father, Carruthers, had obtained a favoured spot on the settee itself, where he held a skein of green wool for Lucy to wind. As Hugh paused to admire Lucy's white lace dress with its girlish pink ribbons on the tight bodice, and her pale blue French boots propped alluringly on a low footstool, she raised her heart-shaped face from her winding and gave him her most brilliant smile.
"You must cede your place now, Mr. Carruthers," she said in a charming tone that brooked no opposition. "You have had the monopoly long enough, and I promised our friend Mr. Grange a real talk."
As Carruthers got to his feet to shake hands and to make his somewhat grumbling departure, the two knitting girls also made their whispered excuses, Lucy leaning her pale curls towards them and lowering her lashes over her blue eyes as they spoke. Hugh had the distinct impression that she and her friends were fully aware of her father's plans, and he wondered how many of the surgeon's other students had been persuaded with tea-cake and a private chat in the conservatory.
"Now, Hugh, you look even more stern than usual," she said, pouring tea into a china cup. "You are quite the most serious and least charming of my father's acolytes, and yet I must confess it makes me like you the most."
"I am honoured," he said, sitting by her side and accepting a cup of tea and a buttered tea-cake from her long, pale hand.
His pulse quickened at the touch of her elegant fingers, and as he felt her breath on his cheek and the slight heat of her body against the coolness of the flowers, he was ashamed of his churlishness.
"Those other boys are so quick to flatter and be silly," she said, smoothing her skirts across her lap. "They present no challenge at all."
"I do not mean to be difficult," he said. "Have I been rude?"
"Not at all," she said. "But as usual, how to make you smile is a puzzle."
"I am not good at parlour conversation," said Hugh. "How are the lakes?"
She talked at some length about her trip, and Hugh learned that she had noticed the baronet and white horses rather more than her father suspected. But she was charming in her insistence that she had missed Hugh's conversation, and when she put her pale hand on his arm, he thrilled again with all the feelings he had discovered in her absence.
"But enough of my silly holiday," said Lucy. "These times make light conversation less attractive, and I know you might prefer to talk of serious matters."
"Indeed I would,"
said Hugh, wondering how to begin some sort of declaration of his intentions.
"My father is set on going to France," said Lucy, with a more serious face than he had ever seen. "I know he has asked you to go with him."
"Yes," said Hugh. It was not the opening he wished, but he would follow her lead. "What will you do when he goes?"
"My father wishes me to go to my aunt in Wales," she said. "But it is not a pleasant house, nor as lively a city. I have asked to stay in London, where my friends and I plan to contribute to the war effort in so much larger a fashion." She paused and gave a pretty sigh. "But I know I should not worry my poor papa when he is making ready to sacrifice so much."
"I'm sure he'll be quite safe," said Hugh. "He won't be in the front line, you know."
"I do so hope you'll go with him," said Lucy. "I won't flatter you, but only say that it would give me such peace to know he has you."
She looked into his eyes, and Hugh felt a vibration between them that inspired him to be bold. "I find that I have missed you this summer, and I do not welcome the idea of going away," he declared.
"Why, Hugh, I missed you too," she said. "The lakes were so dull and full of portly old people that I thought of you with increasing fondness."
He thought she was teasing, but her face revealed no irony. That she should so often be unaware of the funny things she said was a contrast to the sharp wit of such women as his aunt or the schoolteacher, Beatrice Nash, but he thought it a charming symptom of her youth. "I was afraid my focus on my work had made me a dull companion, too," he said. "You are surrounded by medical men."
"They believe they know so much more than they do, and yet insist on lecturing me as if I were a child," she said. "I like that you always speak plainly."
She glanced towards the parlour, where he noticed Carruthers was frowning at them over his tea.
His was not the only glance, and Hugh saw with great clarity that to be at Lucy's side was to be in the very centre of the company.
Affection for Lucy and for her father blossomed in his heart. He understood that the tall brick house and the respected consulting rooms might be his, and that Lucy, raised to understand a doctor's needs, would offer him all her pretty freshness now and be eager to mature under his guidance. The moment hovered in silence while a small fountain plashed in its mossy bowl and a breeze, stirring across the cool, tiled floor, set the flower heads to nodding. At last, Hugh put down his teacup, balancing his large buttered tea-cake on the saucer. Wiping his hands swiftly on his napkin, he seized Lucy's hand. "Dearest Lucy," he said, and now as he looked into her eyes, he felt no hesitation in laying his heart before her. "For some time I have hoped to speak to you."
"Forgive me, but I must beg you not to," she said.
She did not withdraw her hand, but she turned her pretty eyes away and added,
"You know that I hold you in very high esteem, Hugh."
"Then why may I not speak?" he asked, pressing her hand. "Just a brief word. No one else need hear."
"I fear you mean to make some sort of declaration," she said, and lowered her long lashes to her cheeks. "But as I told Mr. Carruthers only last week, it is not possible for an Englishwoman to entertain any pretty declarations from a man not in uniform."
"I don't understand," said Hugh.
"My friends and I have sworn we shall entertain no declarations, no matter how handsome the gentleman or advantageous the match, until he has enlisted," she said.
As she withdrew her fingers and clasped her hands together in her lap, he saw her give the faintest nod towards a large stand of aspidistra. The two girls with whom she had been knitting nodded back. "Surely love must rebel at such an arbitrary test." He could not restrain his impatience at what seemed a silly contrivance. "We are not in some fairy tale, where dragons must be slain and golden apples fetched for the princesses."
"Mr. Carruthers swore he would give up his August holiday in Brighton and go straight to the recruiting office," she said,
a pout to her lips and a flush in her cheeks. "I wish you much happiness with Mr. Carruthers," he said with mock severity.
"In his case, I had hoped he would refuse, and I would be rid of him altogether," she admitted. "But in your case, Hugh, surely you mean to sign up and go with my father? He says it is to be the greatest opportunity for all who follow him."
"I'm sure your father considers duty above opportunity,"
said Hugh. I can assure you, I do not fault your patriotism, or doubt the importance of your father's plans. But I won't join the fools dashing thoughtlessly to the recruiter.
I would expect no less from my stern friend, she said, smiling again. I shouldn't say this, but if you decide to join us, you would be well served to let my father know before the first week in September.
I've asked time to write to my father, said Hugh.
My father plans to hold a large general enlistment rally during his first lecture back at the hospital, she said. You will be expected to attend, and it would look well to show your commitment ahead of the crowd.
A general recruitment of doctors?
The Army Medical Corps is found to be much smaller than required, she said, taking up her knitting again. My father has pledged to recruit 100 men, and I am pledged to attend every rally to hand out hand-painted flag pins to every new recruit.
A charming incentive, said Hugh, glad at last to have hold of an opportunity to return to romantic banter. Perhaps I should delay my decision to claim my token from the lady's fair hand.
I must warn you that my friends and I will hand the white feather to all who dare leave the hall without signing up, she said. And though she ducked her head and smiled with her familiar, youthful charm, there was a hint of steel in her eye that he had not seen before. I have given up an entire swan's wing hat to the effort, and it was from Paris, no less.
Chapter 9. Standing in the high street, her basket on her arm and her straw hat shading her eyes from the bright August sun, Beatrice could see the striped shop awnings with their hastily produced Union Jack pennants strung from edge to edge, the municipal flower trough sporting stiff paper flags on sticks, and every empty wall and post displaying a handbill urging attendance at this evening's public meeting on the war effort. And yet the town's business went on as normal. A delivery dray offloaded crates at the ironmonger. A woman swept the pavement outside the milliner. The fishmonger's boy set off at an awkward run, a parcel of paper-wrapped fish under one arm and a large bucket of live crabs on the other. As a boy tripped on a wayward cobble and almost lost a half-dozen crabs from his bucket, England seemed as peaceful and pastoral as the ages. Beatrice's basket contained a paper bag of broken biscuits, 3 small currant buns, and some elderflower cordial. Her pupils were coming this afternoon for their usual tutoring, and though she did not plan to spoil them, their bored and gloomy faces at the first 2 lessons had prompted her to try these small inducements. The bakery and the grocer had both displayed thin shelves. The big loaves were usually sold out by the afternoon. But today all bread in the bakery was sold, and there had been no fancy sugared cakes at all, not even their almond smell, but only buns that looked smaller than usual. In the grocer all the fresh food was sold, the glass-fronted pie and dairy counter empty, and women were reduced to competing over tins of pressed meat and dried fruit from the uppermost shelves. Honey and sugar being sold, they took black treacle and even brewer's malt.
"I'd like a standing order for 1/4 pound of sugar and 1 pound of flour," said the lady being served ahead of Beatrice.
She had a long paper list and was accompanied by a stout boy who carried a straw basket of immense size.
"Sorry, madam, I'm not taking any more standing orders," said the grocer, who looked drawn and nervous, perhaps from delivering such news all day to unhappy customers. "Even my current orders are being reduced, and likely I won't be able to fill them all."
"When will you get in more sugar?"
asked the woman, and made a written note of the day he mentioned.
"I'll be here, first thing, and I shall expect to find you have kept some available," she added.
"I'll do my best, ma'am," the grocer said.
"But it will be all cash money, small notes only, and nothing on the accounts."
He mopped his balding brow as she swept from the shop, the stout boy laden with a full basket behind her.
"A bottle of elderflower cordial, please," said Beatrice, "and 1 pound of loose biscuits."
"Biscuits is all gone, miss,"
said the grocer, reaching up high for the last, slightly dusty bottle of cordial on his shelves. Beatrice thought it must have been retrieved from deep in the storage cellars.
"I've only got broken ones."
"A pound of the broken, then," she said reluctantly.
shop-bought biscuits might be the necessary compromise of those who lived in rented rooms, but she would not have willingly served broken ones even to servants. However, they might not be frowned upon by hungry boys, and she must have something to nibble on when hunger struck between Mrs. Turber's small meals. The grocer shoveled loose, broken biscuit pieces into a bag and quoted her a price that she was sure she had paid a few days ago for intact ones. "Everything is very dear these days," she said, counting out her coins. "And everyone complaining and accusing me of making a tidy profit," he said. "No one asks me what I'm being charged up and down."
"I didn't mean..."
"And how I'm to keep the shop stocked and make a living when there's nothing being delivered," he added, shaking his head. "I shall be forced to close my doors if things go on this way."
"It must be very hard," said Beatrice, noting that his wife, knitting green socks in the corner of the shop, looked very well fed, and that she had a large slice of fruit cake at her elbow. "I am so sorry for your troubles," she said to the lady.
"Try us tomorrow. Might have a crate of tinned pilchards coming in, and also some French soap," said the wife in a cheerful tone. "That's right," said the grocer.
He laid a finger against his nose to signal the pilchards were a secret.
"But better be early. Be twice the price by afternoon."
Beatrice did not go in the butcher's shop, but she could see the marble slab in the window was empty, save for some dried sausage and a large grey piece of liver. The haberdashery was doing a brisk business, as if people feared a sudden shortage of rick-rack ribbon and polka-dotted Swiss muslin by the yard. Beatrice bought the last 2 yards of some dove-grey, grosgrain ribbon to lighten a black morning dress that had too much wear left to discard. Only the tiny bookshop seemed full of merchandise, and the bookseller stood in his doorway watching the bustle of the high street passing by. Beatrice would have dearly loved to go in and buy a book, if only to cheer him up, but the increase of prices and the lack of cash in the streets and banks made it prudent to hold on to her dwindling purse. She merely smiled as she passed, and he raised his hat in acknowledgement. At Mr. Samuels's purveyor of fine wines and liqueurs, an assistant took the last 2 bottles of Spanish sherry from the window. Through the open door, Beatrice saw Harry Wheaton, in the uniform of his father's reserves. He was lounging against the counter with his cap askew and collar loosened, as if he were wearing boating flannels. As the assistant wrapped the bottles for him, she heard him ask, "I assume my father's account is in good standing in this crisis?"
"On any stock we have, sir," said the assistant. "But if you are able to pay in advance, in gold sovereigns, my governor, Mr. Samuels may be able to procure you some Bordeaux or even some cognac."
"Please make some specific inquiries and send me a note, if you can," said Wheaton.
Beatrice walked on so she would not have to meet him, but before she could reach the street corner, he called to her loudly. Though her ears burned to be so hailed in the public street, she stopped and turned back to greet him.
"Miss Nash, you look the picture of domesticity with your little basket," he said, straightening his cap and mimicking a formal bow. "I hope you have been more successful than I in our meagre shops."
"People with money seem to be enjoying the scramble to stock their cellars and pantries against the end of the world," she said. "But I'm afraid the empty shops and high price of bread and meat will be a hardship for many."
"It's hardship, all right," said Wheaton. "Not a decent bottle of wine to be had in the county. I took 2 bottles of sherry, but not sure why. Overpriced, and I never drink the stuff anyway."
Beatrice laughed at him. "If you don't drink it, you have paid too much, Mr. Wheaton," she said.
"You are right, Miss Nash," he said with a wry grin. "But if I give it as a gift, in these sparse times, it'll be worth more than its price."
"Very true," she said.
"So, please allow me to tuck one of these bottles in your little basket. I know ladies enjoy a spot of sherry now and then."
He made to tuck a bottle next to the bag of biscuits.
"I couldn't possibly," said Beatrice. But in rescuing the biscuits from imminent crushing, she created just the room he needed to slip in the bottle and step back laughing. "Now, Miss Nash, I will have to ask my sister to bring me with her when she comes to tea, and you can offer us sherry with our scones."
"Which I assume you will refuse,"
she asked. In times like these, you should only offer your food and wine to guests you are sure will refuse, he said. My own mother is currently offering all callers gooseberry jam, hoping they will leave hungry.
Since to refuse your gift would mean further public tussle in the street, said Beatrice, I shall accept, with all proper thanks.
Good, he said. I will tell my sister I have made further amends. My sister has been doing nothing but talk of your little cottage. She seems enamoured of playing shepherdess, like Marie Antoinette.
I am honoured to receive her, said Beatrice. She has been most generous. In addition to inviting her to tennis games and luncheons, Eleanor had come to tea at the cottage twice, each time bringing some household items of her own to give. A heavy linen shawl embroidered with crewelwork cabbage roses, a quantity of French tulle left over from dressmaking, and a silver chocolate pot were among the gifts.
"My old nanny made me the shawl," Eleanor had said. "I could never find a decent excuse to part with it, but I'm sure it's much too country cottage for my husband's family." Beatrice had merely smiled and thanked her, caught between a genuine gratitude at Eleanor's attention and the small creep of humiliation at being treated, however gently, as a charity case.
"Now, if I give the other bottle to the German nanny, she might forgive me for dropping the baby on the lawn yesterday," said Harry Wheaton, stroking an imaginary beard. "And on the other hand, I am in the middle of pursuing a rather fetching young lady whose widowed mother might think well of a gentleman bearing such a gift."
"You are a disgrace, Mr. Wheaton," said Beatrice firmly.
"Unless some upstanding paragon of a woman undertakes my reform, I fear I shall remain incorrigible," he said. "Will you not save me, Miss Nash?"
"I shall not," she said. "Good day, Mr. Wheaton."
He raised his hat and went away laughing.
Beatrice, looking around, saw two old ladies frowning and whispering about her in a doorway. She straightened her back and walked away at a dignified pace, resisting the urge to scurry. Beatrice was rearranging fresh paper and sharp pencils on her parlour table, and hesitating between passages from Virgil and Horace in a dog-eared anthology of Latin suitable for schoolboys, when a loud knocking on the back door indicated the usual arrival of her pupils via the alley. Abigail came from Mrs. Turber's side of the house to let them in, and there seemed to be some sharp discussion in the scullery before Snout shuffled through the doorway alone, cap in hand. As always, he had clearly been subject to the scrutiny of his mother, for he was scrubbed red about the ears, and his wet hair was slicked to his head. His clothes, though threadbare, were brushed and ironed, and Beatrice appreciated such respect and felt it as a quiet rebuke to her urge to warn Abigail about the young gypsy. He had removed his boots in the scullery and hopped into the parlour, twisting his socks as best he could to disguise several holes. She almost gave him a smile, but the absence of his fellow pupils meant she must not be charmed, but must offer her most severe frown.
"Artie and Jack are awful sick, miss," Snout began.
He looked her straight in the eye as he lied, and his face wore an impressive frown of concern.
"Might be the bronchitis again, miss. They both had it bad in the winter."
Bronchitis was a stubborn pestilence in the damp British winters, and her father's family had fussed about it as if it might carry him off instead of the cancer. She was not pleased that Snout would raise such a spectre as an excuse, nor that he would think her so gullible as to accept bronchitis in the middle of one of the sunniest and driest summers on record. But she understood that he was the scapegoat, delivering the message for boys who were no doubt among the dozens of children waving at troop trains from the railway bridge, or watching Colonel Wheaton's reserves drilling at their camp out in the fields. "I hope they do not plan to die just to avoid my lessons," she said. The gloom with which all three boys obviously regarded the good fortune of having a Latin tutor for the summer was almost comical. She was not surprised that they should attempt to evade her. "I trust you have no such life-threatening symptoms, young man?"
"A bit of a tickle in the throat, miss," said Snout. "Perhaps I should go home and get into bed just in case."
"Pity you cannot stay to eat up all the buns and biscuits," said Beatrice, as Abigail came in with a jug of elderflower cordial
and a plate with the buns and some lumps of partial biscuit. It was to be a treat, and now I'm sure they will go quite to waste.
"I can stay if it doesn't bother you, miss," said Snout, his eyes widening. "I did my homework, and I brought their homework with me too."
He rummaged in a battered leather satchel and produced the dirty, ink-stained copybooks in which they attempted to translate the passages from Cicero, or Caesar, she set them.
"I would be delighted if you would stay," said Beatrice. "I would like to show you a book that is very special to me."
She went to the nearest bookcase and took down the slim, leather-bound copy of Virgil's Aeneid, from which her father had taught her the poetry of Latin.
"Perhaps you can look at this while I mark your work.
Start anywhere you like." As she marked her changes, she could see Snout munching on biscuits and slurping from his cup. He seemed to become so engaged in his reading that he reached for both without looking, and she bit her tongue and tried not to picture splashes of cordial and crumbs spoiling the pages of her father's precious text. She was surprised to find that Snout continued to display a simple but accurate sense of translation, and that his handwriting, while abysmal, showed some laborious care. Artie and Jack made fewer inkblots, but each rushed into easy translation mistakes, and Jack seemed to have a policy of never looking back, because his paragraphs always finished in cheerful incomprehensibility. When she was done, she joined Snout at the table in the window. He looked up from the book, his face sticky with bun, and gave her an unexpected grin.
"It's a grand story, the Aeneid, isn't it, miss?" he said, his eyes lit up with eagerness. "You can smell Troy burning, and you think Aeneas must die. But then he comes striding out of the flames with his old father on his back."
"He is a virtuous son," said Beatrice quietly. She could not read those books of the epic now without a tear for her own father, who had weighed so little at the end that she would gladly have carried him beyond death's reach.
"He has nothing left, but he never gives up, does he?" said Snout. "And his men. One day you will look back on your problems as if they were nothing. He says to him, 'Forsan et haec olim, memenissa juvabit.'"
"In the future you may be helped by remembering the past," Beatrice added.
"If you don't die first, of course," added Snout. "He lost half his ships just on the way to Italy."
"I've always thought Virgil's Aeneid quite the most exciting of the Roman texts," said Beatrice. "Would you enjoy us all reading it together?"
"I'm not sure the others will," said Snout, wrinkling his nose in doubt. "Usually, we just read a passage or two and use the dictionary to help us write it out."
Though he did his best to appear uninterested, she noticed he brushed some crumbs carefully from her father's book and closed it with unexpected gentleness. "Written translation is far too much work for the summer, don't you think, Snout?" she asked, and was amused to see how suspicion and interest mingled in his face. "It's much more entertaining to read the whole story and just argue about it."
"I'm not sure Artie and Jack'd see it as easier, miss," he said. "You'd really have to try and understand what it says, so you know who lives and who's all lying on the ground with his head chopped right down the middle and his cheeks and brains falling on opposite shoulders."
"It's true the book is rife with bloody gore," said Beatrice.
"The bit where the Queen of Carthage climbs the funeral pyre and stabs herself with a sword, miss. That's a gory bit," he added.
"Would it be too much, I wonder?" As Snout hastened to assure her that they could stomach the full horrors of ancient combat, Beatrice smiled and hid her surprise that the boy had obviously already read the entire epic before.
"Maybe it would help if we acted it out," she said.
A vague plan to excite the whole Latin class with the fun of group performance began to form in her head.
"We could acquire some swords and those round shields, and bash each other in the head while we recite," said Snout. "I'm all for that, miss."
"Very well, we are agreed," she said. "We will spend the summer enjoying our Aeneid again, and in the autumn you three will help me bring the excitement of Aeneas and his quest to the whole Latin class."
"I'm not sure Artie and Jack are going to like it," said Snout, frowning again. "They'll probably work out how to blame me for it somehow."
Beatrice sighed in frustration.
Mr. Grange informed me that you might have a serious chance at the annual Latin scholarship. If you work hard, she said. If you keep worrying about what others will say, I'm afraid you'll deny yourself a real future, young man.
May, sit for a scholarship, said Snout.
He snorted. They'll never give one to the likes of me, miss.
It's offered strictly on merit, Snout, she said. No one will be counting the holes in your socks.
Sorry, miss,
he blushed, and Beatrice regretted her snappishness. No doubt the boy suffered much at the hands of his peers.
We can talk more about scholarships when the term begins, she continued. In the meantime, I suggest you grumble loudly when you tell Artie and Jack of my dreadful plans, but be sure to emphasize the cordial and buns.
Bribery might not be financially possible or morally defensible for the Latin class she would teach in the autumn term, but she smiled to know that for the summer she had two she could bribe and one who, disguised as the most prickly and unprepossessing of boys, had the makings of a real scholar.
Mrs. Turber, wearing a hat like a cabbage, was crushed into the back row of the town hall's council chamber amid a crowd of similar hats, while Mr. Tillingham sat up front, wearing brown tweeds as if they were a general's uniform. Every one of the small-leaded windows in the vaulted chamber had been opened to the evening air, but this merely allowed in the dust of the street and the raucous sound of the town brass band playing down on the cobbles below. Beatrice, who was torn between her moral duty to attend and a healthy fear of being cornered by any number of officious-looking ladies, had almost decided to slip away when Agatha Kent waved her over to a spare seat. If the war could be won by the wearing of red, white, and blue ribbons on one's hat, said Beatrice, sitting down behind a lady with a particularly large and festooned example, perhaps it would already be over. She thought her father would have been appalled at the abundance of frivolous ornament detracting from the seriousness of the times. I assume that the good burghers of small German towns are at this very moment holding similar hot and crowded meetings, said Agatha, fanning herself vigorously with a copy of the printed agenda. Apparently we must attempt to create more committees and official titles than the enemy. You are alone? Asked Beatrice. She could not ask directly after Agatha's nephews, but she had not seen them in a few days, and while she would never admit such a thought publicly, her independence did not preclude a lively interest in the young men. Hugh has been busy helping Dr. Lawton out at the encampment, and Daniel has gone walking the downs with some disreputable-looking poet friends, said Agatha. So I'm quite alone. Where is Lady Emily? Said Beatrice. I expected you both to be in charge. Emily Wheaton is preoccupied with turning a wing of her house into an officer's hospital, said Agatha. That's admirably patriotic, said Beatrice. She hinted that it might forestall the army from taking the whole house and allowing all ranks to run amok in her flower beds, said Agatha.
Patriotic and practical, then, said Beatrice.
Quite, said Agatha. On the dais, the mayor, in full regalia, gavelled the meeting to order. Colonel Wheaton, whose local territorials, it was rumoured, were about to be given official standing as a regiment in Kitchener's new volunteer army, sat to his left. To his right, he was flanked by Mrs. Fothergill, dressed in full uniform of the Voluntary Aid Detachment, with an extra sash of blue and white satin pinned with red roses. The coming of war had given prominence to anyone of official status and in uniform, and so the front rows of the room contained those who had managed to drum up some sort of insignia. They were currently engaged in the tedious process of standing one by one to add their ceremonial notices of support to the afternoon's proceedings.
The Sporting and Working Dog Association wishes to record its unconditional support of His Majesty's Government, said Farmer Bowen, wearing the green sash of the Association Grand Marshal. The Boy Scouts, the Fire Brigade, and the Merchants Guild followed suit.
Beatrice tried not to feel the dribble of sweat collecting along her spine as Agatha continued to fan energetically, and the room cheered and applauded, leaving each speaker pink-faced and very pleased. As the flow of speakers diminished, Mrs. Fothergill rose in a great rustling of starched linen and waited, stern-faced, for quiet in the room. The Voluntary Aid Detachment of East Sussex Rye Chapter offers its colours to our sovereign, she intoned. At her words, an entire row of similarly dressed ladies stood up from their chairs and processed up the centre aisle, carrying an array of crutches, boxes of medical supplies, and flags of the nation, and the association attached to stretcher poles. Farmer Bowen looked quite put out, as if he suddenly wished he had thought to bring dogs wearing rosettes.
"Are we all done?" the mayor asked, as the ladies processed back to their seats.
A tall woman in a severe black linen suit and a small hat rose from her chair. She wore only a single lapel button of office and carried a stack of newsletters.
"Who is that?" asked Beatrice.
"That's Alice Finch, a friend of Minnie Buttle's, the vicar's daughter," whispered Agatha. "They have recently come from London and opened a small photography studio in a converted stable at the lower end of the High Street."
She peered closely at Miss Finch and added,
"I must say that to speak at a public meeting seems a little forward for such a newcomer."
Beatrice smiled to find that Agatha Kent was not entirely immune to the provincial suspicion of outsiders. The smaller the town, the more decades one was likely to be viewed as a newcomer, though in a town like Rye, newcomer was considered a step up from being a summer visitor and totally disregarded by all. The Women's National Suffrage Union, East Sussex chapter, echoes the official statement of its national headquarters in suspending all suffrage campaigning and declares its sacred duty and intention to support all national war efforts, said Miss Finch. Her voice was hoarse, as if she were recovering from a bad cold. "We have more information here if anyone would like a copy of our national directive." The woman next to her, whose wispy curls and ruffled blouse gave her the look of a wind-tousled chick, stood with a hesitant smile and waved a pamphlet. Beatrice assumed she must be Minnie Buttles. The clapping was distinctly muted and mingled with some low chuckles and whispers. The severe woman looked tight-lipped, while her companion blushed.
"Suffragettes," whispered Agatha, as if communicating a great scandal. "I'm quite sure invitations to tea are being quietly withdrawn all over the room."
Beatrice, who had some intellectual interest in the question of emancipation, had never met a suffragette in person. She tried to disguise her quickening interest, for it would not do to show any such enthusiasm. The mayor banged his gavel.
"The town thanks the ladies for their sensible response," he said. "I'm sure my wife, Mrs. Fothergill, could use your members' help with her sock-knitting drive."
Mrs. Fothergill and the severe woman each looked distinctly alarmed at such a prospect, and Beatrice noticed that Agatha hid a smile behind her printed agenda. "I intend to offer our services to the Territorial Army in the form of a bicycle and motorcycle-based messenger service," said Miss Finch, her tone as severe as her manner.
"Quite so," said the mayor. "All plans will be submitted during tea. Ladies' organizations to Mrs. Fothergill at the tea table, and gentlemen to Colonel Wheaton and myself at the desk down here on the right."
The mayor was then induced by Colonel Wheaton to accept nomination as chairman of the War Relief Committee, and proceeded to read a slate of other committee candidates, the local butcher, Mr. Devere, to manage food supplies, Mr. Satchel, the ship owner, to coordinate maritime security, the vicar to manage issues of morale and pastoral care, and Dr. Lawton to coordinate medical services and programs.
"That is a pretty neat coup d'etat," said Beatrice. "Aren't you going to object? Don't you wish to be appointed?"
"I would never presume to interfere in the gentleman's sphere," said Agatha, folding her hands in her lap and assuming a neutral face.
"I will wait, with all feminine patience, to learn where I am needed."
"Really?" asked Beatrice.
"No, of course not," said Agatha. "But the easiest way is always to work through a suitable man. You see, I already have Dr. Lawton in place, which quite puts Mrs. Fothergill and her volunteers where I want them. Now there is just the question of the Belgians."
"As you all know," said the mayor, "the advancing scourge of the German army has been laying waste to poor little Belgium with a ferocity unprecedented in Europe in these many centuries."
"Well, if you don't count the Turks," said Colonel Wheaton.
"Precisely,"
said the mayor. Such savagery has no place in the civilized countries of Europe, or in civilized warfare, and we are called upon to bring relief and succor to the tens of thousands of our poor, innocent Belgian brethren fleeing these atrocities.
How many? Asked Farmer Bowen in consternation.
We thought to fetch perhaps 10 or 12 suitable refugees to begin with, said Mrs. Fothergill. Our illustrious neighbours in the town of Bexhill-on-Sea already claim to have 26, she added. Not that one wishes to accuse them of broadcasting their own generosity.
My wife, as you can see, has already devoted some time to the study of this issue, said the mayor.
Oh, no, you do not, whispered Agatha Kent, rising to her feet and waving.
Mrs. Kent, said the mayor,
if I may beg the indulgence of the room to hear a word from the concerned ladies of Rye, I would just like to applaud dear Mrs. Fothergill on behalf of all of us for her leadership in this area. She paused for a hearty round of applause.
Thank you, dear Mrs. Kent, said Mrs. Fothergill, simpering.
Mrs. Fothergill and I are eager to work on this issue together, continued Agatha, and I believe we ladies have the opportunity to do so under the guidance of a gentleman who not only has been working on this matter locally, but has been asked to take a lead on the national stage.
Who is she talking about?
Said the mayor in a loud whisper to his wife, who could not answer him through her clamped lips.
Her face turned as pale as her dress.
For the sake of the Belgians, and for the opportunity to associate our town with a national spokesman on this issue, I know dear Mrs. Fothergill and I will join Colonel Wheaton and Dr. Lawton in asking the room to nominate Mr. Tillingham by acclamation.
I think Mrs. Fothergill is quite capable.
But the mayor's voice was drowned out by an enthusiastic round of cheering and clapping, which grew louder as Mr. Tillingham stood up from his seat at the front of the room, waving his hat to all sides and bowing modestly under the applause.
"We have our full committee heads, I think,"
said Colonel Wheaton. If he had been primed by his wife to act in concert with Agatha Kent, he gave no sign. The mayor glared, and his wife sat down abruptly, but the room was decidedly in favour of Mr. Tillingham, who made some show of reluctance before mounting to the podium to speak to the room.
"This small corner of immutable England has been a home and a refuge for this poor wandering scribe, and so I cannot express my gratitude that you would entrust me to represent you in this important cause," said Mr. Tillingham.
He held his hat over his heart and looked to the heavens as if asking for divine inspiration.
"In a time of great peril, one cannot but look around this ancient town filled with generations of stout-hearted, generous English men and women, and know that our Belgian neighbours could not ask a kinder, more welcoming sanctuary."
"Actually, the good people of our town are as frugal and suspicious a group as I have ever met, and they actively dislike all foreigners," whispered Agatha to Beatrice. "But we will hope for the best." As the meeting concluded, Beatrice looked around to see how she might escape the ladies, such as Bettina Fothergill, who now measured all women by whether one was at leisure to work full-time on the war effort. Agatha, rising to move swiftly to the aisle, took the time to stop and pat her hand. "If anyone should ask, you are pledged to Belgian relief full-time, my dear," she said. "Direct all further questions to me."
"Thank you,"
said Beatrice, grateful again for Agatha's sharp understanding. As she slipped from the room, she grinned to see Agatha shake hands with Miss Finch and her companion, and direct them deliberately towards the tea-table, where Beatrice assumed Agatha intended their enthusiasm to be the final straw in Mrs. Fothergill's bad day. Snout was after rabbits. He had thin wire snares set below two of the many holes in the bank. A small pile of apple skin left a few inches away. He knew the sweet, clean smell was all in the warren, filling the dark tunnels and causing rabbits to flick sleepy ears and snuffle their noses. As he crouched against the high bank of the dirt lane, his back buried as much as possible into a patch of tall, furry nettles, he could smell the bitter, milky sap of the crushed stalks. The flowers of a tall pink mallow trembled over his head, and he smelled his own warm sweat
and the sharpness of fallen apples in the orchard above the bank. While he waited, he pulled from his bag a dog-eared translation of Virgil's Aeneid. He had borrowed the book for the summer, slipping in